Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
It makes $73 billion worth of investments over the next 20 years. Our North, Strong and Free, invests in new surveillance capabilities for land, sea and air in the North. It leverages Canada's world-class technology, including in AI and quantum, so we can stay ahead of the curve. It creates jobs, and importantly, it supports all those of you who serve. This is about protecting our values, our sovereignty, and our North.
Protecting our sovereignty and our North. That is how the federal government describes its new defense policy over the next two decades. And on top of those commitments, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, emphasized the role that Canada will play as climate change opens more Arctic shipping lanes. Rob Hubert is a professor in the Department of Political Science and the interim director of the Center for Military, Security, and Strategic Studies at the University of Calgary. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
What do you make of this move by the federal government, particularly focused on the North?
Well, there's two things that you can draw from it. The first one is, of course, is that it's welcome that we do see this focus on the North. This has been something that has been developing for a long time. Within that context, this is a major reversal of the government's position on both the protection of sovereignty and Arctic security. Both the 2019 Arctic policy and Strong, Secure, and Engage, the defense policy from 2017, threat of to the Canadian Arctic. And so to hear them saying politics now make us vulnerable is welcome, but you get a little curious about why the change now.
Why do you think the change has been made now?
Well, I think that it's just so overwhelming in terms of what is changing in the geopolitics. I don't think anyone can deny in terms of the actions that the Russians have been taking in the context of the ongoing war in Ukraine, and the concerns in terms of other entries such as China with the balloons and other type of activities in the Canadian Arctic. And I think that this has driven home the recognition the sovereignty and Arctic security is not well defended.
I apologize, I interrupted you just to get further clarity on that. But what was the second point that you were going to make in terms of your immediate reaction to this?
Well, the second point, of course, is the promises. Again, we've heard that this is sort of the procedure that is always taken in that they do come up with ideas. There were good ideas in Strong, Secure, and Engaged back in 2017 in terms of NORAD modernization and other Arctic issues. But it's always promised in the next electoral cycle. It's always promised in 20 years. And we don't necessarily see the actual commitment that is engaged and needed now. So it's fine to talk about in 20 years, but many of these decisions needed to be made back in 2017, to be honest.
But they're specifically making these promises over 20 years. I mean, one of the things that the government is looking to do is planning to buy new Arctic vehicles, build an Arctic satellite station, and set up these new northern operations hubs, which would be $218 million, again, over 20 years to build those hubs. What does that timeline tell you?
Well, the timeline tells us that we really are trying to put it off. We are trying to show that we are taking it serious. And this is very important for the forthcoming NATO summit meeting that's coming, the criticisms that we've had in NATO spending, and also looking ahead for the possible election of a Donald Trump, who's made it very clear that he will be very critical of those states that he feels are free riders on defense issues. And so the political posturing is very important because it does take pressure off. But again, you know, we look at the efforts to build icebreakers. We are finally building two large icebreakers, but we've been talking about this since 1985. Again, we've put off getting the F-35s, which are a central element to the defense. And we have said we'll think about buying submarines. And that's another major element that needs to really have been made already about 10 years ago, if I'm being honest.
Canada has these four diesel submarines that it bought used from Britain. Two of them have never actually been to sea at all. What would having new submarines mean for this nation? And in the context of, again, defending the North?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. There are difficulties. I mean, all four have gone into sea, but it's been with huge efforts. The problem is, of course, is that conventional powered subs can't get into Arctic waters. They can get right up to the edge of it if you're really, really careful. But in terms of any response to the type of threat that is now being seen, in terms particularly for Chinese and Russian capabilities, conventional powered subs simply don't provide you with that capability. You either need a breakthrough in what's called air independent propulsion, and this seems to be what we're thinking about, or we have to go to nuclear power. And that's challenging and expensive. But if you're truly going to try to meet these underwater threats, this is the way that most people think you have to go.
The government has talked about a year-round presence in the North. Is that possible? And what would that do if it is possible?
Well, it's very possible. I mean, put it in context. Russia has roughly the GDP of Canada. We're roughly akin, I mean, from year to year in the last 15 years or so. The Russians, depending on how you do your calculations, have about 15 to 20 bases in the Arctic. Now, they're a different entity. They're focused on very different foreign and defense policies mm-hmm. than us. I get all that. But again, if Canada has the political will, there's no question that we could have the capabilities of having a 12-month presence in the Arctic and a substantial one. But it comes down to political willingness to spend the money to do it. We are in the ballpark, but it's political will.
It's not just Russia. As you've mentioned, China has an interest in the North, and you've written extensively about this. How has Beijing prioritized the Arctic?
Well, there's four or five major issues for the Chinese. And of course, everyone was shocked in 99 when a Chinese icebreaker showed up at Tuktoyaktuk. But that was our first real indication how serious they are. They're first of all interested in the science because they're going to be affected by climate change as much as everyone else. And you have to understand what's happening in the Arctic to understand climate change, full stop. Second, they're interested in the economics. And we see this with their constant effort to get control of any of the resources, particularly when it comes to the critical minerals and other related such materials. They're also interested in terms of navigation, and that's part of their Polar Silk Road. And they're also very interested in being a part of the polar governance, and that's why they want to be a part of the Arctic Council, the Arctic Fishing Treaty, and so forth. The last one, though, the one that they don't quite talk so much, is that they have clearly indicated that they want to have an Arctic security capability. And we see this with their announcements for the third icebreaker that's going to have a deep diving submersible. We see this with their announcements that they've learned how to have an under ice SOSIS, which is a listing capability for submarines under ice. And we see this with their efforts to get surveillance capabilities with the balloons or other unidentified objects that went over the Arctic.
One of the things we often hear from people in the North is that those in the South don't have a sense as to what life in the North truly is like. Does that help explain to you some of the slow walking of the execution of these ideas? That it's hard to fully grasp what's going on when the seat of government is literally thousands of kilometers away from what we're talking about?
I think that's a major element. I mean, until you've actually spent any time in the Arctic, it's hard to fully appreciate what the climate, what the distances, what the lack of infrastructure actually means. And I think that this is part of the problem is that for, I think, a lot of our political elites, it's just so overwhelming, they'd rather not deal with it. I think also, though, that we come back to the issue that we've always felt that the Arctic somehow just by itself makes itself secure because of these factors, when in fact that's not the case. The huge expense that is required to actually do it in any form that's meaningful in terms of the protection of Canadian Arctic sovereignty and security. And, you know, it doesn't get votes. This is out of sight, out of mind for most Canadians. And I think the sort of assumption that the Americans will inevitably take care of it means that's why we've ignored it for so long.
Does that change? Just before I let you go, does that change when climate change is such a pressing concern there? And for example, you're seeing potential access to new trade routes or resources because of a melting Arctic.
Absolutely. And it's that mixing of the fact that as climate change is so apparent, but also the changing geopolitics is so apparent. And I think this is why we have the defense update with such a focus and welcome focus on Arctic sovereignty and security.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Matt.
Rob Hubert is a professor with the Department of Political Science, interim director of the Center for Military Security and Strategic Studies at the University of Calgary.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Natan Obed is president of Inuit Taparit Kanatami. It's a national Inuit organization representing 70,000 Inuit living in dozens of communities spread across Canada's north. Natan Obed, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You met with the defense minister, Bill Blair, about this new Arctic defense policy. What did you say to him about your priorities, and are you satisfied with what you heard back?
We've been having an ongoing conversations with the Government of Canada, from ministers of defense, such as Bill Blair, to the Prime Minister, to the whole cabinet, about what Inuit interests are in relation to Arctic sovereignty, in relation to defense spending, and also in relation to the future of the work that we could do together. This policy update does speak to a number of the conversations that we've had, especially in regards to mixed-use infrastructure, the inclusion of Inuit communities within a policy context, and also just the recognition of Indigenous communities is, I think, a step forward from a military policy that for much of the last 75 to 80 years has completely excluded Inuit and Inuit rights in the conversation of Canadian defense.
The federal Northern Affairs Minister, Daniel Vandal, said that Northerners, these are his words, Northerners will be at the heart of our work. Have you been at the heart of the government's work in past?
No, I mean, that is an overstatement. For the listeners, Inuit Nunangat is the term that we use to describe the entirety of the Canadian Inuit homeland in Canada. We have modern treaties with the Government of Canada, and it encompasses about 40% of Canada's landmass and 72% of its coastline. So we're talking about upwards to 4 million square kilometers of this country is either owned or co-managed by Inuit. 72% of Canada's coastline is the same. We have a massive policy consideration when it comes to defense, when it comes to sovereignty of this country. And what we've been lobbying and advocating for decades is for the Canadian government to recognize this reality and to partner with us on the very real concerns that we have about sovereignty and defense, but not wanting to just be, at the whim of nation states on how they perceive these problems and how they would like to work on them.
It speaks to some of the work that you've done around advocacy for sovereignty and self-governance. What is that connection between Inuit sovereignty and self-governance and the broader issues of Canada's Arctic security and sovereignty?
Well, from the primary piece, Canada doesn't have a claim to Arctic sovereignty without Inuit. It just doesn't. We live there. We have 51 communities across the Inuit Nunangat region, and we've lived there from time immemorial. The Canadian government in the past has done things such as relocate Inuit to further assert Canadian sovereignty. And so Canada understands this and has since the 1950s that we are an essential piece. That said, we are not an essential partner. We have been making strides, working with the Canadian government on defense contracts, working with CSIS and Department of Defense on being more integrated into conversations about security risks and threats. But there is a long way to go, and we need to look no further than Denmark and Greenland to understand a bit more about how other nation states involve in Inuit in matters of the state.
What could we learn from them?
that there ultimately is not a risk of respecting Inuit self-determination in and allowing for Inuit to participate in strategic ways in asserting sovereignty, in defending Canada, and also in imagining what defense looks like. And for us, it is us living healthily in a healthy way in the Canadian Arctic. We have massive infrastructure deficits. We've hoped that in this policy update, this will get us closer to mixed-use infrastructure. But a lot of the infrastructure that we use every day is built off the backs of the Americans. And from Cold War and post-World War II spending, we need to move beyond that model, but we need to do that with Canada.
Is that, you've used that phrase a couple of times, the mixed-use infrastructure. And I mean, I mentioned earlier this idea of $218 million over 20 years for an expanded presence at military institutions, looking at creating year-round infrastructure that, in the words of the government, meets the needs of the territories, the Indigenous people, and northern communities. What could that mixed-use infrastructure do? What specifically would help the people, to your point, the communities that are already there?
I'll start with an example. There are distant early warning sites that are manned across different latitudes to this day across the Canadian Arctic. They are under the purview of the Department of Defense. It is up to Canada and sometimes NATO or U.S. government to decide who can land there, who can use that infrastructure, who cannot, and why. Often Inuit communities are not primary considerations in policies surrounding access. Often these sites are remote, but considering the lack of infrastructure across Inuit Nunavut, they can be very strategic. We need to find ways into ensuring that Inuit and Inuit communities can utilize infrastructure that is built perhaps for other purposes, but ultimately is the most practical way in which we can access any number of things, whether it's medical care, whether it's emergency response, or sometimes just basic community resupply and access to airstrips or ports that allow for us to make the most of the infrastructure. Those haven't been primary considerations. Mm-hmm. And what we would hope is that, especially for the Canadian government and the U.S. government, that they would imagine Inuit as partners rather than trying to exclude or be concerned about the use of these strategic sites by non-military personnel.
We just have a minute and a half left or so, but does that speak to what we were just talking about with Rob, that idea that those in the South perhaps don't understand what's happening in the North? I had a conversation last week with the Premier of the Northwest Territories, and he said that's his primary challenge in many ways is to explain to people down South what's actually happening in his community, what's happening in your community. Is that what's at the heart of this?
Yes, absolutely. The unconscious bias of Canadians. When most Canadians think about the Arctic, they think of vast wastelands. They think of uninhabitable spaces. When we look at the Arctic, we see our homeland. We see all sorts of opportunities. We see comfort, and we also see people. We inhabit all of these lands. This is our home. And somehow that is a point that often really just is lost in the policy and the political conversations by people who are not from the Arctic.
You feel like you're getting closer to making that point?
We hope so. Mm. We have come a long way in political conversations, but with this policy update, now is the time to actually make good on it. And we've embedded a number of our priorities in regard to defense in the Inuit-specific action plan under UNDRIP implementation. Mm. And so we do hope that the exercises that we have done with the Government of Canada to embed our interests and theirs in policy and in legislation will come to fruition in the coming years.
I'm really glad to talk to you again, Natan Obid. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt.
Natan Obid is president of Inuit Taparit Kanatami.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.